You're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida on your dial and streamed on the internet at khen.org. KHEN is community-supported radio, and this is Truth Quest with Melody. And if you'd like to listen to the archives of tonight's program, it is archived at www.givemesometruth.info or is linked from the khen.org website under local programs. You can contact the program while on the air at khen.dj@gmail.com, and if you have any questions for our guests. And if you'd like to become a member or underwriter for KHEN, you can contact us at khen.dj@gmail.com. website, or give us a call at 719-539-1069 during the week from the hours of 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And support for KHEN in this program is brought to you by Kevin Barnes and TruthQuest. Kevin Barnes of Agent for Land Home Property Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land pack home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of KHEN staff, volunteer, or board of directors. And my guest this evening is Jennifer Lake, and my co-host is Katie O'Brien. And Jennifer is a former nursing student who entered the program as an older person in her 40s, graduating at the first certified level. The best possible result came through researching the disease of polio, which proved to be life-changing and on a par of 9/11. Jenny is a lifelong researcher and activist on a range of subjects from environmental integrity, natural foods, healing arts, and religious history. She describes herself as awake and paying attention and has contributed interviews and articles to the web-based Truth Sites over the last year, 2008. Jennifer, are you there?
I'm here, Melody.
And Katie?
I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, can.
How about you, Jennifer?
Yes, I can hear you fine, Katie. Sounds good.
Okay, great. Jenny, I'm going to let you take it from there a little bit and just maybe elaborate on what, you know, I started out with, and then we can kind of break into the area of research that we talked about earlier and we thought might be of interest to our audience.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for asking me on. I was surprised initially that you even found me because I have so little out there on the net. But, you know, I'm just really getting started as far as spreading the word. I've spent a few years really looking at this ever since polio came along in my life as a thing. And as you said when you introduced me, that happened about 3 years ago. And I've been on the subject ever since. And it was really a golden thread in a lot of ways. It tied up things that I've been looking at for years and years. It just had my attention, all 100% of it, all the time, and that's still the case. But it's a very big story, and I learn more every day. So what I really wanted to be able to do was to tell you what I found and the way I got into it. And it started off as a project that I had to do in school. And we were looking for nursing applications, actually, but looking at this disease and standing up in front of the class and having to say, so such and such causes this disease. And I was very near the end of my class. Everyone else went ahead of me. And I had about 3 months to prepare this. And as we were going down the line and I was listening to other people present, they were standing up and they were saying things like, the cause of this illness is unknown. And that just seemed to be fine. And I had already given myself a mandate in the beginning to go after that cause. So the reason I still do it now is because I'm pretty hooked in as a sleuth looking for the cause, and I have found it. It's gotten to be a very deep story now. It's taking me back 150 years into medical history. So the scope, really, of where this goes, beyond polio, which is a 100 different illnesses, and this is the thing. We think that we buried this back when the vaccine came along in the 50s, but in fact, almost everyone on the planet now has had a polio vaccine, and it's really a brain infection, and everyone really is susceptible to this because it's a disease of pollution. It's caused by chemicals, it's caused by radiation, and of course it's caused by experimentation.
So are you saying then that it's everything that we didn't think it was?
Yeah, in a way. What I really think it is, and you know, this is the very heavy part of this whole story, is that I think it was a bioweapon from the beginning, that they knew exactly what it did to people, and that back in the 1880s, there was an orchestrated spreading of this knowledge within a group, and we've just been at the mercy of this whole system that has grown up around it ever since.
But that wouldn't be the only isolated disease or anything of that sort, because of this group or what grew up around that. Am I correct?
There were certainly a lot of diseases running the streets in those days, but indulge me a little bit in looking at this whole thing from a very conspiratorial point of view.
Well, that's fine with me.
Okay, well, because this is where it went. And I guess what I should say is, you know, just start in with what happened in the beginning. When I first jumped on the net and went looking for the cause of polio, it linked all over the place. And it went to all these neurological illnesses, like multiple sclerosis and lupus and Alzheimer's and everything, Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. I got into animal versions of it, and there were literally hundreds of diseases there. And I thought, how can this be? How is this possible? So about 2 weeks into it, I just had this enormous list, and I was very confused. And then I came across a testimony that was given before the Senate on Gulf War Syndrome. And it was done by a man named Howard Ernovitz, who runs a chronic illness research institute. And I think he meant this to be casual. He said that when he was a grad student, they used to induce polio in their lab animals with radiation or chemicals. So that was a big aha moment.
I bet.
Yeah, and I went from there, I just kind of grabbed onto that, and then I went looking at nuclear history and nuclear testing and started finding places where that would go and all the things that came up from there, and there's more diseases now added to the list. There's chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia and all kinds of neurological disorders. So it just got very huge, very fast, and even for my presentation, I don't think I nearly had it together, but I felt that, you know, to give it a real honest go, I made a timeline, and I basically showed the history of this and how different polio was. It was different from other diseases of our era because so much has been made of it. March of Dimes was created. Posters were plastered on grocery store windows, children in braces and crutches. And, you know, there was so much controversy about the vaccine when it came out in 1955. And there's still so much controversy today because the World Health Organization is still pressing very hard to push the polio vaccine into every corner of the planet and make sure that every person gets a polio vaccine. Interestingly enough, in Belgium and France, it's the only vaccine that's mandated by law. So I thought there is something very special going on with polio. And I learned that back in the 1880s, they knew the pathology of this. The early neurologists had discovered that people who were afflicted with these paralysis disorders and palsies, they had all these tangled nerves in their brains, and they were just shriveled up, and they would just get sicker and sicker, and paralysis was just an acute form of this. But almost any kind of poisoning could produce that. And so the deepening part of this story was to get back to basics for me, to learn more about how the metabolism works, what virus really is, and how to deal with this. Because this has really seeded the population of the world with chronic illness. And that's a very frightening prospect. And that's kind of the nauseating part of this.
I mean, before you get into explaining what it all is and everything as much, can I ask you one question? Is because I know that you're going to go into an avenue that I know is new to me, and I have, you know, a little bit of understanding of some and background of where you're going, but of course I'm not a professional at it or anything of that sort. And what I'd like to say is with your background, and you were in nursing, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And the information that you have, what kind of reception have you gotten from anyone? Have they been supportive of you, or are you just a maverick?
I wouldn't deny I'm somewhat of a maverick, but I get mixed reception. Are you talking about how other professionals respond?
Yeah.
You know, I don't really talk to a lot of people about this.
Okay.
I put my head down in the research. I think this is very, very hard to accept. When you really dig into this and you look through medical history and stuff, the polio vaccine is trumpeted as a major triumph in the world. So, in terms of our own lifetimes, I mean, this has been the benchmark of progress, medically speaking. And I think it's very, very hard for people to accept that.
I mean, because what you're going to come about talking about will turn a lot of things on their ear when it comes to understanding how this sort of thing works.
Well, it's okay.
No, I don't have a problem with it. I'm just saying that it's interesting. I just know how, just when I come up against my naturopathic training and the medical profession in the past, it wasn't an easy road to go down. I mean, now it's much more accepted, but for a long time, those of us that really took that path for really, fighting, swimming upstream.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think we're just always going to swim upstream for a while, So this is a good workout for our flexibility here. But this went so many places for me, and it really got me to look very deeply at food and how people learn about nutrition. One of the more interesting things about it, though, was this theory on microbes that I'm developing. Part of that is from environmental studies that I've done on soil science and soil life. It's kind of fascinating to look into this. The NASA scientists are kind of telling us a lot about this stuff. They're saying that we are 90% microbes.
Interesting.
And that's more than a compost pile, actually, I think. And that being true, then we're in a very symbiotic relationship with our whole environment. And for polio to stand out so much, it really speaks to me about the nature of pollution and what's going on, all the chemicals that are getting dumped into the environment. And there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 80,000 chemicals that are in common use now, and less than 3,000 of those have been tested for human safety. So that's pretty stunning. Mm-hmm. And there was a competing theory about biology at the time that germ theory came along. And what it was called was pleomorphism, and it has to do with different forms that microbes change as the environment changes that they're in. And they can be, particle things like what we think of as virus, and they can become bacteria after that. When the environment changes again, it can transform into something else. Today they call it polymorphism. But when Pasteur came along, he called his theory monomorphism. And that's really where we get the germ theory of disease. And there's a famous story about him confessing on his deathbed that he was wrong. And he said that Claude Bernard, who talks about bioterrain, he said that Bernard was right. And that it's not about the microbe, it's about bioterrain. So it's about the chemistry within your own self. This is going to determine the state of health that you're in. And that polymorphism naturally working in the body is going to make use of whatever chemicals are inside you. And some of the nutrition advice that I've been getting the last few years and the people that I've been reading about and listening to have a lot to say about the true nature of virus as a solvent. And they're using this now. Actually, the pharmaceutical houses use virus to break down tumors. They call it virotherapy. And they're taking advantage of this natural state of virus to break down cell material. So when our bodies get sick and we have a lot of cell damage inside, when the normal flora, the things that we're made to think are parasitic, when those things can't take care of us and clean up that damage, then virus gets produced and they do the job. So you don't want to have to be in that state of having viral infection, but it's certainly an indication of how you're doing.
So is it kind of like a second system that kicks in then?
Yeah, this would probably be your last line of defense. If you were in a bad state, you might not survive a viral infection. But initially, this is what polio was made out to be. But in fact, the early epidemics of polio, there was no discernible virus that they could find. Now, the way they did that is they would make a serum. They would mash up a disease victim, and then they would take the fluid pulp, and they would strain it through a very, very fine strainer until they had what they called a filtrate. And they would take that and they would put it into an experimental lab animal. And if it made that animal sick, then they believed that this unseeable agent in this filtrate is what caused the disease. But what vaccine, antagonists, the people now who are coming out against vaccine are very clear, and the studies are very clear that you put anything inside your bloodstream that doesn't belong there, and it's going to make you sick. So this was, I guess you could call it faith-based medicine. I wouldn't know what else to call it. Not medicine, really. But back in the 1880s, the way I see this history is that this started off really as a war on milk. And they were telling parents and they were telling health officials that children were getting polio from milk. Well, at the time, they were putting formaldehyde in milk because they were feeding it to the cattle, actually. A dairy cow will produce more milk if you feed it formaldehyde. So it was coming out in the milk. They were even adding it afterwards to as a sterilizing agent. But there was a big push on from the 1890s onwards for milk to be pasteurized. And they were saying at the time that besides polio, they weren't really making a big deal of that at the time. The disease that was most affecting people in places like New York City would have been tuberculosis. So they were saying that tuberculosis was in the milk and that the cows had tuberculosis and that they had to pasteurize. Now, the man who was pushing this more than anybody, and this is how milk became a controlled substance, it was almost a debate between two fellows, one named Nathan Strauss and a doctor named Henry Coit. And Henry Coit, that name might ring a bell to you if you know a little bit about Johns Hopkins history. The president of that institution was named Daniel Gilman Coit, or excuse me, Daniel Coit Gilman. And, you know, so when I learned this, you know, these are little red flags to me. It gets my attention, and I look more deeply at the subject. But Nathan Strauss was the owner of Macy's Department Store, and he was known as a major altruist. He did things during the early 1890s when there were lots and lots of immigrants flooding into New York. He was taking care of, in particular, the Jewish immigrants that were coming into New York and setting up dispensaries for them to get food and clothing. They were setting up funds for them to pay for their housing. And at that time, I think New York was about 30% Jewish, so that was a very popular thing to be doing. And what he did really, he created his own laboratory and put a lot of his resources into this project. And through these labs, they were training doctors and nurses. And what I learned was that at the same time that he was doing this, they were beginning to clean up the New York City public water supply. And it's impossible, really, to sort out if there was any benefit from what was done at that time with the pasteurizing of milk in New York, or if the real benefit came from having cleaned up the water. So I had written an article about that, and you know, in intent to just keep looking at this and looking at the whole situation with milk. But I'm fairly amazed that given the choices that they were able to make at the time, that the doctors, the health professionals, he had an awful lot of opposition, but they managed to get this through by being very persistent. And, of course, right now, you know, there are very few places where fresh farm milk is even a legal product. There's just a handful of states where you can buy it from a store shelf. And milk is an ancient healing food. There's a lot of literature about how the ancient Egyptians used it. and babies, unfortunately, that are fed on formula and not ever given a chance to have breast milk, have lifelong problems with their intestines. And for some of these kinds of people, and I'm one of them, fresh milk, fresh living milk, is a perfect food. So this is a personal stake that I have in this process to see what happens here.
So did you find out that those that are lactose intolerant, that has something to do with the pasteurization process then?
That would seem to be true. So I don't have any statistics on that. I don't know.
Okay.
But imagine having to be a mammal and be lactose intolerant. I mean, that's a tough call. So, you know, in its most general sense, a lot of what I see here is that the things that really are perfect foods for us are now becoming not foods. And things historically that were not our food are becoming our food.
Well, do you want to get into a little bit further on why, I mean, the mindset of the people that were working back in the 1800s and what they had in mind when they were doing what they were doing? Are you following what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I'm following that. You know, I try not to probe too far into the mindset. I see this as a group mind, not so much an individual mind. I think there have been people in this world that are that stand apart and keep themselves apart, and they look upon the rest of us with fascination. You know, even in the polio expose, the man that discovered the virus in 1908, his name was Carl Landsteiner, and another one of his discoveries was that human beings are amazingly adaptable and that they have the ability, no matter how many novel kinds of antigens, which are things that challenge our immune system once they get inside of us, that we have this ability to manufacture antibodies and other kinds of necessary biological things that will defend us and adapt us to the antigens that we encounter. So that's kind of an amazing discovery, and it gave them permission, I think, to just keep a never-ending experiment going with us, to see how interesting we are, to see how well we can adapt. You know, the 1880s, this is the height of Victorian industrialism. The chemical codes of so many things were being cracked at this time. And everything was lending itself to industrial process. So chemistry just began making amazing leaps and bounds, and physics, too, at this time. And so much of the medical establishment that we have today was modeled on the New York health establishment. And so really, you know, finding a place to search, that's the place to go and look and see what happened there. And you've heard of Rothschilds, yes?
Yes.
Yes. Well, the Rothschilds were married into the families that began these clinics and these hospitals. And so they are very much underneath this establishment. There was one hospital in particular that was called the Jewish Hospital for Deformities and Joint Diseases. They eventually shortened the name. It became just the Hospital for Joint Diseases. Today, it's a part of the NYU medical establishment. But it was started actually in the home of the Rothschilds in New York. And two brothers started this hospital. Their name was Frauenthal. Henry and Herman Henry married Clara Guggenheim, and Herman married Minnie Rothschild. They set themselves up to be a drug dispensary. They had 7 beds. Within 1 year, they moved this hospital to Madison Avenue, which became their long-term home, and they just kept expanding and expanding on the spot until they had grown a huge world-class hospital there. It turned into the leading orthopedic hospital of the whole world. And for how long it held that position, I don't know. But an amazing amount of work went on there. And it was really theirs from the beginning. And so that's just one example of how this happens. Now, what's interesting is that Henry Frauenthal, in 1914, wrote a manual for infantile paralysis. This is long before any of us ever heard polio, or they weren't even calling it polio, I don't think. Poliomyelitis is what they called it, and that's inflammation. But he was traveling on the Titanic when it sank and managed to get in a lifeboat, and then he produced his manual 2 years later. And it was based on 3,000 cases. That's a lot of polio. This hospital that he was working out of, the Hospital for Joint Diseases, they were pioneering a lot of surgery there. And polio victims, of course, needed lots of surgery. And lots of them got awful surgeries, and maybe they didn't need them either. But very strange thing happened to him. In 1927, he went plunging off the 8th floor of his hospital to his death. And right away, when that happened, his wife, Clara Guggenheim, was hauled off and committed to an insane asylum for the rest of her life. So something went terribly wrong there. And I look at those things as just suspicious events, which just gives fuel to this fire that polio was developed as a bioweapon. Now, what the real culprit here in this story is the director of the Rockefeller Institute, and his name is Simon Flexner. And these families are well-known Zionist families, and he held on to this research. I mean, he literally sat on it for 30 years. And
so are you saying he got a hold of the polio research that the Rothschild, was his name Rothschild?
Well, the Rothschilds had the hospital, and Rockefellers had the research institute, but they actually shared their labs all the time. It just went back and forth. There was an open door there in the lab sharing. But he's one of the people, when you look at the biographies, he's one of the people credited with discovering poliovirus. And even the man that found it, his name's Landsteiner, he came from Vienna, and he came over to the Rockefeller, and he spent the rest of his career at the Rockefeller also. But Flexner had a couple of brothers who have an awful lot to do with how medicine and law and education are carried on today. He was the elder of Abraham Flexner and his other brother, Bernard Flexner. There were quite a few children in the family. But Abraham Flexner is famous for having written something called the Flexner Report, and it was a survey of medical education in the United States and Canada. And it was a whirlwind tour. He visited something like 160 schools, and he graded them. He gave them marks. And I read something kind of interesting about this tour. For the amount of time that he had, in those days they had to travel by train or even horse and buggy, I think. He had about an hour, I guess, at each place. If that. And, you know, so he he kind of went down his list. He threw his report together. At the time, it was funded by Carnegie, and it was issued as the Carnegie Bulletin Number 4. And he praised his own alma mater. He thought it was the best school, and that was Johns Hopkins. And, of course, Johns Hopkins had already been set up by Skull and Bonesman to be the premier medical institution in the country, the main medical school. They actually had labs before they even had students. It didn't become a medical school until 1893, but they already had a biology lab, a chemistry lab, and a physics lab there, even though they didn't have a curriculum and they didn't have any students. But they did have people like Simon Flexner working in the labs. So this is where he primarily got his education on microbiology. When he was a kid, he worked for his oldest brother in a pharmacy. And there was no training necessarily for pharmacies back then. It was not required. So anybody who had the will and had the gumption, I guess, could open a pharmacy. And so this is mostly where he learned, because he dropped out of school in the sixth grade. And he did go to Louisville, Kentucky College, but how that went, he couldn't say, because when his brother got a chance to do his medical school review, they got a very bad grade, and they had to be assumed into the University of Louisville. So that's how some of the schools stayed alive, is they got sucked up into the university system. But the Rockefeller establishment officially comes into being in 1901. So it's a very symbolic kind of a marking to me. I look at that and, you know, we have all this benefit of hindsight. And I think that there was a plan. I think the Rothschilds had a plan for us, and that they intended to have control of us in 100 years. And some of the things that have been sort of telegraphed by intention up through time to us have been statements made by people like Colonel Edward Mandel House, who was a very close private associate of Woodrow Wilson. And he made a statement, allegedly, that we were going to be owned. Our biology was going to be owned by them. So I took it seriously.
And what time period was this in?
This is really all between the 1880s and World War One. So World War One was a consolidating of an awful lot of this agenda, you might say. Industry came under, for war purposes, came under the control of Bernard Baruch, mm-hmm. who was a Wall Street stockbroker. The finances came under a man named Eugene Meyer. They were running the commercial activity of our government for World War One. They were sitting right at the top of the heap.
What do you think their intention is in regard to owning us?
Well, at one time, I thought perhaps that their intention was just to keep experimenting with us. But I don't think that anymore. You know, the deeper I've gone into this, I think that they just intend to get rid of most of us. They don't need us.
As in depopulating the earth?
Yeah.
And that they've come up with something better?
You mean a better way?
I don't know about better in their terms.
Well, they've come up with something better for them.
Right.
versus...
Well, you know, one of the things that's just been happening all along, just, you know, as much as we've become, you know, drawn into this money system and there's money banking, they've been doing genetic banking also. So when I look at experiments and things, I realize that they were teaching themselves how to create life. And they did it by taking life. But they have learned how to create life. In 2002, using mail order parts, they constructed a polio virus. They say it's the first virus that's ever been put together in this way. This was done at the State University of New York, which is a Brookhaven lab partner. Now, Brookhaven, you may know, is out on Long Island, and it assumed the activities of Cold Spring Harbor Labs, even though I think Cold Spring is still in operation. they had a separate establishment, but I think it's all now organized under Brookhaven Labs. And they've also constructed E. coli bacteria. They've constructed the most virulent kind, and that's probably a fairly new entity on the planet. They think the reason this very virulent E. coli even exists is from grain-feeding cattle.
And from grain-feeding cattle?
Yes.
Because they're herbivores.
They're herbivores, yes. They're supposed to eat grass and things like that. Grain is not their natural diet either. And neither is it ours. And there's a book called Man and Microbes. It was written by a man named Arno Carlin. And he is one of many voices that elucidates this idea that as we became agriculturalists, and we started raising grain crops, we became smaller, we became weaker, and we became sicker. And it is not our natural diet. So we've got millennia of evidence to look at for that, and that's all very true. So grain is not our natural diet either, but it works. And it's cheap. And, of course, they've learned to produce this very cheap now, although it's not going to be cheap for very much longer. I saw a $5 loaf of bread in the store the other day.
Saw one. I've been paying that for a while.
You have here, too.
Well, we can live without grain. And, in fact, a lot of people drop this out of their diets in order to get well. And a lot of the dietary stuff that I've been looking at, coming from things called the Paleolithic diet, or the primal diet, instincto diet, raw animal food diet, and I've been doing this myself now for about 2 years. I've been eating raw eggs and fresh raw milk and raw meat and raw fish, and I've added this to my diet, and I'm not a very big person, and then I don't eat a whole lot, so you know, I'm not going to keep the meat industry in business by a long shot. But a little bit goes an awfully long way, because this is really, to me, what a new concept here of what living food is, that it's not about eating fresh vegetables. It's about eating microbes, about ingesting proteins and fats that are in foods that have not been distorted by cooking, that have not been destroyed by processing of any kind. And it's making an incredible difference. So I'm very happy about that.
Well, you mentioned earlier in regard to wheat and that we really didn't need grains.
Right.
I have read a lot in regard to our history. Grains have been in use for a very long time, maybe not at the excessive quantity they are today, mm-hmm. is we take in a lot of wheat. But it's almost like something has been done to the wheat that so many people are winding up allergic to it.
Yeah. And
it
the
has
same
been
with
hybrid.
Soy.
Go ahead.
Right. Well, you know, we've been hybridizing things for a very long time and making them domesticated so that they're easier to grow. Now, you go back, way, way back, and people were eating wild versions of these foods. But, you know, it's if you think hunter-gatherer, if you put that thought in your head, you know, it would take you a long time to gather some grain. You know, the sort of big wild versions were used. But
yes.
People still primarily, plants were supplemental. They still ate game and they ate used dairy and they ate eggs and they supplemented with grain and plants. There's nothing wrong with eating grain, but, you know, it's hard to look at things like a Twinkie and say, oh, that's made from grain. You know, I guess Twinkies don't exist anymore. Is that right?
When you were getting into the part about the E. coli and the grain and the animals, where were you going with the E. coli part?
Well, I was just letting you know that they've made it. They can make it from scratch, just like they made poliovirus from scratch.
Okay.
That they can actually get the component parts and put it in a petri dish, I guess, and bring it to life. So this is the theory of pleomorphism. You put these chemical components together and put them under the right circumstances where they combine, and that's generally some kind of a stress. And they will. And they don't even necessarily need to be stressed to have this occur.
So are you saying that these two different versions of, what do we want to call it, germ theory? Or is it, how would you describe the two? But it sounds like one was promoted among the public and the other one wasn't, but they were actually using both.
Well, that's the way I see it, yeah. I think that the germ theory became public medicine and that polymorphism became the secret science. It was the research science. And, you know, in order for them to actually create life forms, that just seems natural. It would have to be that way. So they had this knowledge. It was really for thousands of years going that way anyway, the knowing of polymorphism. This had gotten to be a fairly sophisticated understanding by the time that Pasteur came up. And, you know, he was pasteurizing wine. And before we were pasteurizing milk in this country, they were pasteurizing beer that Anheuser-Busch, famous for having, you know, the first ones to distribute pasteurized beer. And they were so happy. They could send it everywhere, and it stayed crisp and clean in the bottle and everything else. And the man who advertised for them, his name was Albert Lasker. And he had an advertising company called Lord & Thomas. And Lord & Thomas promoted the idea that this was clean and safe, that was part of the promotion. And by the time World War II rolled around, Albert Lasker and his wife, Mary, and I'm not sure that he hadn't actually passed away at that point. Maybe not. But the Lasker Foundation became the self-appointed advocate of the public health. And it's kind of an amazing story how that unfolded. But the characters that are involved are very interesting people. Mary and Albert were introduced to each other by William Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, and Louis Lichtenstein Strauss. Now, Donovan was in charge of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. That became officially our CIA. And Strauss, who was related to Nathan Strauss in some way, I'm not exactly sure of their the nature of their relationship, but he became the chief of the Atomic Energy Commission. And what was interesting, too, about Strauss, and this is where polio and milk and all these things weave together into one story. He was at the age of 21 in 1917. He became the president of the Hospital for Joint Diseases, the Rothschild Hospital in New York. He didn't know anything about medicine. He had no education in medicine whatsoever.
And this is Strauss you're talking about?
This is Louis Strauss.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
I think he pronounced his name Strauss or
okay.
Strauss.
Okay.
But I'm calling him Strauss out of habit at this point by seeing his name so many times and thinking Strauss. But at the same time that this 21-year-old guy becomes president of this hospital, he also becomes the personal assistant to Herbert Hoover for the U.S. Food Administration, which started off as the Committee for Relief in Belgium. This was a huge enterprise, supposedly organized to supply Germany with food and other necessaries to keep the war going. This is the way Eustace Mullins explains the reason for this organization. But Strauss is really sitting there right on the right side of Hoover, calling the shots. And one of the things that he was supposed to do was be a liaison for the Joint Jewish Distribution Committee, who were given a free hand at taking what they needed from the supplies that were being provided and distributing them on their own. So they had no oversight from our government for the supplies that they were given. And then the rest of it was pretty much in the hands of Hoover and Strauss back in 1917. And they kept this organization together until after World War One, and then there were a whole lot of offshoots of making different organizations sort of under this same blanket. One of those was the Belgian-American Educational Alliance, something like that. And their first program was to set up a medical program for Belgian children and offer them dentistry. This was began in 1920 and extended through the 20s. Now, I thought that was interesting because, and Colorado has a connection it probably doesn't know it has, but they were really interested in fluoride back then. And there was a lot of fluoride in the water table in Colorado. And they were openly, but not very organized, it seems, but openly experimenting with fluoride on school children back in the 1920s. And I was looking for, I had some specific references of some stuff I came across. It didn't mean a whole lot to me to keep the references at the time. I just got the general gist of it. But a man named Frederick McKay was the dentist. In fact, he had come to Colorado Springs in 1901 and set up shop as a young man. And he said that immediately he noticed that there was a problem with people's teeth, that they had this mottled brown and white spotting growing on their teeth. and this was dental fluorosis. And he started looking at it then in 1901, and he made that his special project. But by the 1920s, with permission of public health officials, and they got the whole National Association of Dentists, who were, I guess, had been organized for a couple of decades or so, got them involved in this experiment that they were doing with kids. So fluoride was happening in a lot of places besides Colorado in the 1920s. It was also happening in Belgium. And that's the thing when we look into human experimentation, is that I realized I had to go far afield, and since they've been pushing us into this internationalism for so long, they've been running these experiments all over the world, wherever they can. And it seems like a very coordinated effort when you look at it that way.
Well, when you were naming the organizations that seemed like they were totally unrelated, but it, you know, when we talked earlier, it was like you were saying when you went to dig into something, you didn't just take that as the answer. You would dig further, and you would go several layers deep, because there often was more involved in why things took place. And these people going from atomic head of the Atomic Commission to the FDA, is that what you were?
No, actually, that was one of his later jobs, was being the chief of the Atomic Energy Commission. But when he was young, he started out at the same time he became the president of a hospital. He became Herbert Hoover's right arm for this food administration program for World War One. And he also became a partner in the Kuhn Loeb Banking House. And Kuhn Loeb, they were notorious railroad financiers for a long time, but they were also Rockefeller's financiers. And in fact, Strauss, during a brief period where he went from being an atomic energy commissioner to being its chief, he had a little time off in there, and he was the personal family financier for the Rockefellers.
Can I, let me go ahead and stop here just a second and say you're listening to KHEN LPFM radio at 106.9 on your dial, and it's streamed on the internet at khen.org, and KHEN is community supported radio. And this is Truth Quest with Melody, and my co-host tonight is Katie O'Brien, and we are talking with Jennifer Lake, and she's giving us information on her research into the history of polio. So, go ahead. Oh, and let me say, the views expressed by this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Okay, Jennifer.
Okay, well, you know, when the history gets kind of intricate when you start looking at the relationships that the people have. There was so much going on with intermarriage, and, you know, I mean, it's the real, true old boy network going on. And these are families that stuck together. And, you know, the Rothschild families built dynasties, just like the monarchies of old. You know, they take this same template of behavior and apply it to themselves, and this is how they kept their family together, and, you know, how they used their money and peddled their influence. They did it the same way. But what's really damning when it comes to polio is to look at X-ray history and then to carry this up through time and look what was going on during nuclear testing. And the fact that this all came together in the 50s, this is the time. We were exploding nuclear bombs at kind of almost hard to fathom how much radiation and how many bombs were exploded well beyond testing. They used them to test all kinds of things. They were even thinking of using them for construction purposes. So they had to test that too. But X-rays, when I started, I didn't actually know about the early history of X-rays. It goes back into the 1700s that they were actually able to produce X-rays, but not very good ones. And they figured out by 1896, a man named William Röntgen made the first useful X-ray. And he took an image of his wife's hand, and I think it took 15 minutes to make the X-ray of her hand. And she was so unhappy that she'd never let him do it again. But at the same time, they discovered radioactivity. So this sort of came hand in hand, you might say. But X-ray history, in December of 96, he publishes and lets the world know that he's got this amazing new technology. And within just a couple of months, anybody who could build an X-ray machine had one. And they just were everywhere. And there are amazing stories. In 1896, they immediately started using it as treatment. So they weren't interested in looking just at bones. They wanted to treat you with the X-rays because they thought radioactivity was curative. There's a story that the Army Medical Museum in Washington, D.C., had an X-ray machine there, and a doctor who knew that took a young patient. He had a 17-year-old girl who had a bullet in her hip. So he took her to the Army Medical Museum, and they gave her a one-hour X-ray because they were having a hard time finding that bullet. So she got a one-hour exposure, and at that time, I don't think they really understood what they were doing. There wasn't any method of regulating how much radiation people were getting from these X-rays. There was another doctor who was using them to treat cancer right away. He was actually giving people long-term exposures just to the X-rays.
And this was back when?
This was back in the 1890s.
Okay.
There was an electrical engineer who was offering people X-rays. And in 1 year, he performed 1,400 X-rays. So it dawned on me how prevalent this was, that this was not small potatoes. This actually was quite a thing.
Well, wouldn't that have also exposed him to the X-rays or were they wise to protect themselves at that point?
No, they didn't protect themselves. They got exposed also. And by 1930s, there were so many people that had used X-rays, technicians and doctors alike. So many of them had died that a doctor named Percy Brown wrote a book about it. He thought they were glorious martyrs that were sacrificing their lives for science. So, yeah, they knew very well what X-rays would do. And, in fact, there's a kind of an awful story about the assistant to Thomas Edison. He was Edison's glassblower. And they were working on fluorescent lighting, apparently. Are similar because they use a cathode tube.
Mm-hmm.
And he was messing around with this and using his hands to manipulate these cathode tubes and got burned. So he took a direct burn from the X-ray. And in fact, that was the dose, by the way. They would burn you and then they would scale back a little bit so you didn't burn. And that's how they figured how much to give you. So they would stop just short of a burn. But he got burned in the process of working in the lab, and that was in 1898. And he was dead 6 years later, but he got very sick within 2 years. he had radiation sickness and he couldn't work anymore. And by 1902, they had to amputate his right arm. And then a year and a half later, they had to amputate his left arm. And he didn't live much longer past that. So that happened by 1904. And Thomas Edison swore off x-rays. He said that he would never use them again. As far as I know, he didn't. So they did know how deadly they were. No secret. And that's just the thing. You know, when you look at this, and they knew how deadly this stuff was. Madame Curie, her real name was Marya Skłodowska. She discovered radium, or she's credited with that, she and her husband, Pierre Curie, 1902 or thereabouts. And by 1908, Pierre Curie was so sick that he was run down to death in the street by a horse and buggy. He just either didn't see it or hear it or couldn't get out of the way. But he was very debilitated from his exposure to radium. And she lived quite a bit longer, but she eventually died from leukemia. So did her daughter and her son-in-law. But he didn't die before he was able to help with the whole atom bomb effort. He was a big part of that. And he was also a known communist, and so was Marie Curie. She was also a communist. So they were very active in helping to bring nuclear bombs into the world. And interesting to me that one of the people that I learned the most about x-rays from, a man who just died a few years ago, his name was John Goffman, and I heard him speak back in the 70s. He was a wonderful speaker. He spoke about the policies, the official policies of the Atomic Energy Commission, that they had to officially deny that nuclear power in any form was detrimental to people's health. So they were instructed to lie at all costs and at all times. And he said that their motto was, the solution to pollution is dilution. So that says a lot. He always supported nuclear bombs. Amazing. He just did incredible research about x-rays and how deadly they were, how many diseases they cause, and I still haven't read all his books, but I know from looking at all the research that was done about x-rays and how they use x-rays, the military has almost an unending stream of available information about radiation illness. By the time the Manhattan Project came along, it was already a done deal. It was just a matter of when. And the stories of having those been dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki is that they had every intent of actually dropping these bombs so they could find out what would happen. They wanted to know exactly what would occur. Now, what's so interesting about polio coming into this picture is that they knew from their x-ray studies they were able to induce polio with x-rays. And by this time also, there was a massive amount of evidence that polio was caused by pesticides. So they really probably, were not concerned that eventually it would come out that pesticides caused polio, because that's a pretty good cover. It hides the fact that radiation causes polio, and radiation causes many other illnesses as well. But I think, because of it, that some of the people who worked on these projects believed that if you could develop antibodies to polio, that that might be an anti-radiation serum, that they could use that. So what makes me think that the most is the first vaccine trials that they did after the war. In 1951, they went to Provo, Utah. A doctor named William McDowell Hammond organized what they called the gamma globulin trial. And gamma globulin is the antibody-containing serum from whole blood. They just take the serum that contains the antibodies, and they give it to children now for used to be I think for hepatitis. That was one of the things that they would treat them with gamma globulin. Maybe even measles and something like that. I think I had that when I was a kid. But they took gamma globulin from polio victims to use for these trials. And they started the trial in September of 1951 in Provo. Now, Provo didn't have a medical hospital, but it did have a state hospital. This was an institution for mentally retarded, people who needed supervision. They did have a state hospital there. Apparently, a lot of the state hospital wards became part of this project. They also used school children from the towns around Provo. But Provo is what I call a double downwind place. It's just due east of the Dugway Proving Ground, which is where the Army's Chemical, Biological, and Radiological School is. Dugway is famous for being the scene of bacteriological release and other bioweapons, where they did open-air testing there at Dugway. And they had just reactivated it at the beginning of the year. And they were preparing to be in the Korean War, so that's why they had all this stuff in gear, never really scaled down from World War II. Just sort of a matter of paper that things were decommissioned or deactivated. They never were. And, of course, the Nevada test site is downwind of Provo on a bad day, I guess. A lot of the fallout that left Nevada would go north and east most of the time. Of course, it went all over the place. It depended on what day they were testing. But on a regular basis, most of Utah got a pretty full blanket of fallout. So Provo made rather an ideal spot for fallout testing, for biological weapons and for fallout. And they started this gamma globulin trial on the 4th of September. They inoculated almost 6,000 kids, and then they put them under a watch period, and they kept this watch period going until the 1st of December. Now, what's interesting is that in 1951 in Nevada, in October, 6 weeks after these kids got gamma globulin, which was what they thought was the protection period, they thought 6 weeks was about right, or at least this is what they said, they started a testing series there called Buster Jangle. And this was the first nuclear test in Nevada where they had soldiers on the ground. They called that the Desert Rock series, where they put, in this case, they had 6,500 soldiers on the ground. So it strikes me, and that test, by the way, ran until the 29th of November. And 3 days later, they end this observation period for the polio vaccine gamma globulin trial, the Provo. It was perfect timing. They were monitoring and taking blood samples and possibly using these kids as gamma globulin factories for the 6,500 soldiers who were on the ground at Buster Jangle Test. And
what would make you think that along that lines?
Well, the timing.
Well, other than the timing, but what I mean, them being the factory for it. So are you...
The kids. The kids who were part of this experiment.
Right.
If they were given gamma globulin serum from polio victims, they already knew that they could potentially double the volume of antibody production against polio virus.
Oh, so you... Okay, all right. I'm following
you
now.
So this was a kind of a concentrated and relatively risk-free way of generating a lot of human serum that has polio antibodies in it.
Okay, and the radiation helps accelerate the body's ability to make it? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, they injected antibodies there, yes. The radiation, a result of being irradiated, is that your body might develop polio virus. Yeah, that's
a
way that it could go. It doesn't have to be that way, and it certainly isn't that way in a lot of cases, but that's the thing about the polio disease, is that people can manifest the symptoms of acute poisoning as paralysis, and it may have nothing to do with polio virus. So this is just part of the scam in a way. They found that other viruses have the same effect and that can cause polio. What they have in common is that they're enteroviruses. They're all formed in the intestines, and radiation damage is done mostly. The most sensitive organs that you have are your small intestine and your bone marrow. That's the most radiosensitive part of a body, of an animal's body also, in a lot of cases. So radiation will damage those organs and cause lesions there. The small intestine is a vital part of the lymphatic system. It has what they call Peyer's patches. These are lymph nodes that are in your intestines. And if you damage that, then there's a good chance that enterovirus then would move from your intestine into the bloodstream and into your brain and give you a nervous system infection. And I think I said this at the beginning, that polio was a brain infection. It's a form of encephalitis. And that was proven long before these vaccine trials ever took place. That was proven. And it was also proven, and Albert Sabin, who made the oral vaccine, and this is the kind that I had, and this is the kind that I think most people, 50 or younger, would have had this particular vaccine. You have it on a sugar cube. That's how I got it when I was a kid. And he proved that polio virus caused the flu. And at the time, whenever there was a large polio epidemic, there was also an epidemic of flu. They called it grip, and that was what the French called flu. So it's very, very tied in here to flu. And interesting to me to look back in history, I also looked deep into the Spanish flu epidemic. What I think partially occurred at that time, just a few years before. Now, of course, it was wartime when this happened, but a few years before, there had been an amazing breakthrough. It's called one of the biggest chemical discoveries of all time, and it was a process developed by two Germans who worked for IG Farben, called Fritz Haber and Karl Bosch. Karl Bosch was the president of Farben. They figured out how to extract nitrogen from the atmosphere and make it chemically useful. And that process, the Haber-Bosch process, was developed and patented, I think, in 1910. By 1913, they were using it to manufacture ammonium nitrate, which is the fertilizer that we're all familiar with. It revolutionized modern chemistry in a way. It made an incredible amount of products suddenly available with the use of nitrogen-based chemicals. And to an animal or to a human, if you get too much nitrogen in your system, it starts a process of what they call catabolism, which is the opposite of anabolism. You've heard of like anabolic steroids and things like that. Those are for building up cells, and catabolism breaks them down. So nitrogen will do this. It becomes nitric oxide in its actually processed by the cells themselves. They make nitric oxide because catabolism is important. It's an essential part of the energy exchange in cells. So if you get too much of this and you only need a little bit, your system goes into this catabolic state where it starts actually poisoning itself. Nitrogen will replace oxygen in cell metabolism. So something I just read the other day is that radiation actually reduces it doubles the effect of nitric oxide on your cells. So it makes you twice as sensitive to nitric oxide when you get exposure to radiation. One of the many ways that it makes you sick. But during the Spanish flu, you know, suddenly nitrogen-based products and nitrogen-based agriculture was going on all over the place. And food was being mass-produced. We were all geared up for war. I mean, it had been happening for years, but now suddenly there's all of this nitrogen product available. And it was coming in the way of sundries through pharmacies, you know, coming as additives, coming as medicines, coming as food and fertilizer. Nitrogen naturally can concentrate in plants. This is what plants thrive on. This is what they have to have. Now, animals kind of typically get nitrogen poisoned. And what's fascinating to me when I looked at this was that in animals, the symptoms that they have are almost a mirror of what the Spanish flu symptoms were in humans. So that was eye-opening to me. We know that nitric oxide makes people sick, but it's really hard to get any kind of clinical review. At least I haven't found any because I'm surfing the free web. I don't pay to get into these archives and read this stuff. There's so much literature that's out there and free that I don't want to pay them to read these experiments. But I found it in the veterinary manuals. It was very clear to see that these were the same kind of symptoms. Now, the Spanish flu was not like any kind of flu that I ever had or that I ever heard of. This was like hemorrhagic fever. People were were dissolving from the inside, it seemed. They were bleeding from their ears and from their eyes. They were cyanotic, which means that they were getting no oxygen. Now, this would nitrogen would do this to you if it replaced oxygen in your cells.
Can I ask you, now, is nitrogen used as, it is used as a preservative, too, isn't it?
As a preservative?
Mm-hmm. In a kind of preservative form, or am I?
I don't think so, but it might be. I don't know all of the chemical uses of nitrogen.
Okay.
But
or forms of it, I don't know.
You're talking about in like in meats, right? As,
right.
Nitrites and nitrates and meats. Yeah, I guess so. I don't know if it's there as for an antibiotic, if that's what it's supposed to be doing there. I'm not hip to all the additives at this point in food. If I don't know what they are, I just don't have them. So that's my own personal rule. Not that I'm sure I've had them because I've had bacon in the past, and I don't know that there is such a thing as a package of bacon that you could get from the grocery that doesn't have nitrates and nitrites in it. But there are just so many ways they could get into your system that this is what I was looking at, and what I observed reading the veterinary manuals is that you can actually accustom animals to ingesting nitrogen, but you have to do it slow over time and just give them little incremental doses at a time. That, I guess, you know, would help them survive if all they have to eat would be plants that have been grown with an abundance of nitrogen fertilizer. You know, given drought conditions and things like that, those are other reasons why nitrogen can concentrate in plants. So even for grazing animals, you know, in a dry climate where there's only scrub for them to eat, they could potentially be at risk for having nitrogen toxicity from eating the plant. So I speculated that that was a cause and a part of a cause, because it's never that simple. You know, they say that the Spanish flu killed 100 million people or more, and that they think they'll never actually account for it. And when you jump on the net, you still see sites that say 20 million or 40 million, but the more recent material that's come out, and this may be just a scare us, but they're saying 100 million people died, and they'll never know how many people actually died from Spanish flu.
You're making it sound like the symptoms of it is somewhat maybe similar to Ebola.
Well, you know, that kind of may play a part in this. You know, as far as I know, Ebola and Marburg, which are related diseases, they're caused by what they call a filovirus, like a filament virus. It's the shape that it takes. But Marburg appears in the world in 1968, and then Ebola appears into the world in 1976. And to the best of my knowledge, at this point, there aren't older cases of having those diseases in the world, but there certainly were other kinds of hemorrhagic fevers. If they were going to play around with something in a lab, the suspects to me are the pneumococci, which are parts of the bacilli of pneumonia, and plague. I read the book that sort of the most comprehensive library book tome that's out there. It's called The Great Influenza. It was written by a man named John Barry. And by reading his book, I kind of put my finger on a few places of suspicious interest. in the whole story of the Spanish flu, or probably not the whole story, but the one that he told anyway, he said that there were a couple of locations where they say the virus mutated and that it became another entity, really. It became extraordinarily virulent. And one of those places was Louisville, Kentucky, and the other place was Sierra Leone in Africa. Now, Louisville, Kentucky is very suspect because this was a Flexner family home. Simon Flexner was the director of the Rockefeller. Louis Brandeis, it was his family home also. And in 1917, or 1916, I guess, he was appointed by Wilson on the Supreme Court. And he was operating under a plan from the moment that he got power. And Sierra Leone was a British property at the time, and it was really their gateway into colonial Africa. So during the war, they used that place. They sent their ships there for coaling. They were all steam coal steamers in those days still. So they had to have ports of where coal would come and they could ship out. And what makes that kind of an interesting place is that a ship full of sailors arrived there and they were sick with the flu, but only the dock workers, and these were all the black workers who were calling the ships there. Within 24 hours or so of the arrival of these sailors who came sick, it's the dock workers who started dying of this horrendous disease with all of these horrible symptoms. So I have no doubt that it was a bioweapon. I just don't know exactly what they were doing. But there had been reports that Switzerland, which was neutral during the war, they were reporting that they had the plague there, the classic bubonic plague, the Black Death. Now, the reason it could have been the plague is because there was plague here in the United States in the years before the war, and it happened in San Francisco. In fact, they were kind of on a revolving catastrophe going on there with plague. In 1901, we have the same cast of characters participating in Spanish flu, and the Rockefeller, Simon Flexner, had the chief of the NIH lab at the time, and his name was Milton Rosenau. And another man who I think at the time he was part of Johns Hopkins, he certainly was for a lot of his career, his name was Llewellyn Barker. He also worked at Rockefeller. They were sent to San Francisco as a team to deal with the plague and to collect samples. They collected samples of everything, everywhere they went, every event, every kind of, altercation on a world scale between nations that the U.S. got involved in. There was always a medical contingent that went as part of that. They went wherever the soldiers went, but they specifically collected samples and tissue and anything that they could preserve and bring back and bring to the labs. They were directed to do that. So they were there to deal with plague in San Francisco in 1901, and it was actually a hot spot for political corruption and trouble at the time. So just the events that were going on there, sort of heightened the possibilities of what could have been going on. But now, these are the very same men who later, when their Spanish flu, they were leading teams of people. Milton Rosenau is credited with having single-handedly built the NIH, put it together in its modern form. he was a one-man show with a secretary, and he's responsible for having buildings built and labs set up, funding coming, picking staff, making partnerships with other research institutions.
NIH, meaning?
The National Institute of Health.
Okay.
Or Institutes of Health. Actually, it's plural. He's responsible for putting it into a modern form and making it a research establishment on a par with other research labs at the time, like Rockefeller and like Johns Hopkins. But he was 10 years at his post there, and then he was employed with the Navy, and he was the chief in epidemiology at the Chelsea Naval Hospital in Boston at the time of the Spanish flu. And a lot of people think, and you know, some of the writings and articles that are out there, they say that it started in Boston. But in fact, I think the real story is that people arrived in Boston with the flu, as they say, but they would have been treated by this man at the Chelsea Naval Hospital there. So, and all the soldiers that got sick at Fort Devens, and that particular place took a very hard hit. Now, I'm aware of a story about this having been caused by vaccine, and the vaccine that the soldiers were getting at that time would have been for typhoid, what they called the TAB vaccine. And I had also read that there had been a confession after World War II from a Nazi that he had heard in the 1920s that they had already in the U.S. Accomplished something. He said he called it a double punch bug, and he meant by that they had managed to marry a virus and a bacteria in such a fashion as to cause this exactly what the Spanish flu would have been. So what they could have married at the time would have been something like plague and polio, or the pneumococci and plague and polio, or something like that. But certainly the science that we can know now about polymorphism and the creation of life is that they would have been able to do this. So it's not a stretch to say that at all. That's very possible. And it could have been more than one kind of disease. When it started in Kansas at Fort Riley, Camp Funston there, that's sort of the zero point of Spanish flu. There was a lot going on. It could have been, at that point, it could have been a double punch bug that they had made with hog cholera. That's a very good possibility. They knew a lot about it. And one of the men that worked on flu and is now somebody, if you look at the whole situation that we're in with avian flu, that this is our next pandemic, you know, they want everybody to run out and get themselves vaccinated for this flu. The man who brought this into our time after World War II is a man named Richard Shope. He also was a polio expert, as actually they all were. They became polio experts before they moved on and learned other things. But he became a flu expert. And in 1951, the story I told you about them doing the gamma globulin trials in Provo, Utah, he became the head of the Army's what they call the Epidemiological Survey. That's our bioweapons program. And he was the chief. And he was the chief of that program at Fort Detrick from 1951 till 1959. And his specialty was hog cholera. He knew that disease inside and out. So, not that his timing had anything to do with Spanish flu, but they had a very good hold on these microbes. And of course, this is a creative process. This is like, you know, having a whole paint set and a blank canvas. It was that interesting to them. And really, it's that possible. They were able to do things decades ahead of what they told the public they could do. So,
it seems to be a modus operandi for a lot of stuff that takes place in research.
Sure.
And that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's just this driver that's underneath all this activity. To me, I see it as eugenics, and that all connects. I mean, that is, the money goes there, the families go there, the professional genealogies, you know, people who they worked with, the mentors of these people. When you get into the wartime stuff, and stuff that happened in 1939 when they were getting organized for war, they set up the Army Epidemiological Board. Initially, they called it the Commission for the Survey on Influenza, the Influenza Commission. And their intention was to sort of use the battle cry of Spanish flu and set up listening posts, they called it. They had surveillance at every university campus and in every hospital in the United States, so that should anyone check in with flu, the Army would be the first to know. And this system never went away. It really is the CDC and the bioweapons programs of today. So,
well, they still, a lot of times, I mean, I just had a brother pass away a year or so ago, and that was who they wanted to notify for tests and that sort. So they still kept a pulse on all of that, even though, I mean, it looks like they're doing the good of the people, but at the same time, it could be utilized in another way if need wanted to be. Is that what you're saying?
Well, surveillance, you mean?
Right.
Oh, well, sure. You know, they want records. They want to keep records on people. They want genetic samples from people.
So where would AIDS or ALS or some of these things that you hardly heard about in the past are now quite prevalent, where might that come in? Have you run across that in your research?
Yeah, that's part of the spectrum here with polio, because that's a motor neuron disease. It is part of this. You know, what I see here, as I see that these early neurologists, now there was a man who was an expert on ALS, back in the 1860s and 70s, his name was Jean-Martin Charcot, and he was a practitioner in Paris. He was a teacher of teachers there, and they call ALS Charcot's disease in Europe.
Hmm.
And we call it Lou Gehrig's disease here. But this is one of those demyelinating illnesses. It infects your nervous system and infects your brain. And, you know, there's a whole lot to know about these, and I'm sort of slowly collecting information about these diseases. But what's interesting, really, from my perspective of the present, is that, you know, I believe that these people understood exactly what kind of damage that could be done with chemicals. They knew about pleomorphism. They understood this. This was biology of the day. And exposing people to chemicals and toxins, and they weren't necessarily thinking radiation at that time, but, you know, chemicals would have been the suspect early cause of a lot of this stuff. They knew that mercury was very poisonous to people, and yet it was in all these old-time snake oils and things that they sold. And people were getting sick and dying from what they called mercurial diseases. It was all the mercury that was in these potions. So,
isn't there mercury that's in some of these vaccinations, too?
Mercury, there's a product they call Thimerosal that's made of mercury. Yes, it's in there. Uh-huh. But, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of things in vaccines. There's a lot of DNA from all kinds of critters that is part of that mix. So you're getting foreign DNA, what they call xenobiotics. You're getting chemical additives in there. They actually add some of these substances in there so that it'll provoke a stronger response. The body will respond with the immune system will actually fight, and it'll make more antibodies this way. It'll go on attack, and they call those adjuvants. And they're usually some kind of, at least in the past, some kind of a fatty substance. So they were using oils and things like that for adjuvants. But that's turned out to be such a major disaster. But, you know, the early polio vaccines had that in there. And just the adjuvant by itself, even if you didn't have anything else, will give you an autoimmune illness because that's how much it doesn't belong inside you. Scary story on vaccines. You know, it has a remarkably well-documented history of how dangerous they are. So, you know, even I think the American public, I think we're not afraid of vaccines. We've all gotten multiple vaccines and we're still walking around. But we don't see the context in which this chronic illness is really coming into everyone's life. It really hit me a few weeks ago. I'm sitting outside on the side of my house, out in the trees. It was just a beautiful sunny day, and a couple of my neighbors were coming down the street. And these are young women, and one of them was pushing her baby in a baby carriage. And I caught just a little piece of their conversation as they were going by. And she was saying that her child had been born with asthma. And it just hit me what this is all about. Babies are getting born with chronic illness. So, you know, the health fascism that is coming and that we all know is coming, you know, it has everything to do with deceiving us and clamping down on our behavior, and it's hiding these gross crimes of mass irradiation of the public. There's a book called Deadly Deceit, Low-Level Radiation, High-Level Cover-Up, and I got a figure from these guys that wrote the book. Two doctors wrote the book, but they said that we've been exposed to the value in fallout of 40,000 Hiroshima bombs.
Wow.
I couldn't add it up myself. I tried, but once you go from kilotons to megatons, which is 1,000 kilotons, you just can't count this. And if it has exponential effects in terms of our health, there's no way to even evaluate what this really is. You just have to look at the data and just go after the empirical data, because it's out there, but it's just scattered all over the place, and it's a matter of pulling enough of this story together where it starts to make sense. And so polio made it make sense to me when I saw that they could irradiate someone, and that 4 years later, that person could get polio from that irradiation that they got. And that was commonplace, and that's in the military documents. It has delayed effects, and it doesn't require poliovirus to do it. But because they know that poliovirus is one of the entities that can form as a response to the damage from irradiation, they really thought that polio antibodies might have anti-radiation properties. That's what I think. I feel pretty sure about that in the story. But to me, that would be part of the delusion that was being perpetrated by the good doctors. The bad doctors, and not sure who all that is at this point, but I think Jonas Salk was one of them for sure, and Albert Sabin, and, you know, they've gone down as heroes.
What about Hillman? Was it Hillman?
Hillman? Yeah. Well, you know, he was on the bad payroll, that's for sure. You know, he has the credit of having produced more vaccines than any doctor in history. So that kind of puts him on the other side of the fence.
What about Gallo?
Well, Gallo, you know, Gallo seems to be in up to his eyeballs in this whole conspiracy. You know, you want to talk about HIV, that's really not something that I know a whole lot about. I've learned enough about it because this is really just an extension of the same laboratories and the same people and the same funding. You know, they're doing the same kind of work. They're taking these microbes and they're taking bits and pieces and they're doing genetic recombining, and they're coming up with novel microbes and they're testing them on people.
Well, then where did the death of some of these microbiologists, I think, was it the Marconi Institute that was, is the one in England?
Boy, there's been a lot. Two graduate students. Are you talking about that particular incident that happened in London?
Yeah, but I think there's a number of them.
I think there were two students together that were horribly killed and stabbed many times over. But, you know, this is par for the course. This happens all the time. And, you know, a leading expert on this disease or that disease, I remember something that happened near where I live back in 96. Now, that was the year that mad cow really popped into everybody's consciousness. At the same time, the world's leading expert on Alzheimer's, which is linked to mad cow, he was murdered. And he lived in, or at the time, he lived in La Jolla, California, which
well,
is
didn't
where
his plane crash?
No, he was murdered in his driveway.
And this was the guy who was the top guy on Alzheimer's?
Yes, at the time. Hmm. I can't remember his name. But he was with his young daughter. He had his, she was 10 or 12, and they live in a gated community with full security, an upscale place. Not too far from UCSD, the Salk Institute, Scripps Clinic, General Atomic. Those are all in the same neighborhood. And he was on his way home, and what was said about what happened to him is that a vehicle with black tinted windows followed up behind him, pulled up behind him in the driveway, and when he had gotten out of his car with his daughter, and they apparently didn't know this was happening behind them, but they got out and they were trying to get to their front door, and that they were just gunned down right there. And whoever it was just fled. They fled the scene. They said that his wallet was not taken. They didn't make an effort to break into the house in any way. They just assassinated him there, and then they left.
Well, Jennifer...
So, you know, there's a death for just about every situation. You know, you can just... Mm-hmm. Just figure that that's going to be just part of it at this point, because, you know, the criminals are.
It has been so nice to hear you tonight, and why don't you tell our listening audience where they can find your material?
Well, they can find some of it. Now, I don't have a whole lot up there. I have some articles at IamTheWitness.com. They can find some more interviews at 911weknow.com. Those two websites. I have another interview coming up soon. I just got this on the schedule on Thursday. I'll be on RBN with Rick Adams, and they can listen in there too.
Well, you know, it's certainly been interesting, because it's amazing where you get started in researching something, where it can take you. And
yeah, it's a lot of stuff, Melody, you know, and I hope it to put this together in a way that people can, you know, see for themselves how things fit together, because there's too much to talk about. So I have every intention at this point of putting up more articles and maybe even bringing this into a book.
Well, it certainly would be an interesting one, I can tell. And as far as, I mean, it still comes back. It doesn't matter what direction I seem to go. I seem to find a way to bring it back around to what's going on in this world right now is a large-scale eugenics program. And, yeah, I mean, yeah, you could say it's by accident, no way, but nah, there's just so much evidence out there, and they speak about it in their own right, that, you know, they needed to populate the earth.
Well, I'm very convinced from doing this medical research and looking at polio and looking back in time and finding all the threads and at least pulling on them enough, I'm convinced that genocide is what they have in mind for us, because they know how. And I think, you know, with this obvious will to limit us and control us and make fewer of us for the future, that what else would you call that? I mean, that's genocide.
Well, again, Jennifer, again, thank you for coming on the program and giving us your story, and hope to maybe have you back again here in the future.
I'd like that. Okay. Thanks for letting me tell it. I appreciate you very much for
well,
asking me.
Thanks for
on.
Your contribution in doing all this valuable work.
Well, thank you, Katie.
Okay,
nice
well,
to be with you.
Okay, well, Katie and Jen, I'll go ahead and say goodnight, and then we'll say this is KHEN 106.9 Salida. And it is... this has been Truth Quest with Melody.